From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And today we're going to be talking about some of these upcoming events. Want to remind everybody about them and put some background to it. I can't avoid the word grab bag. We're going to touch on a number of matters. We're going to talk about... Primarily, I want to tout some books. Everybody knows we've been talking about Tony Lea's book, The Truth About the GM, the 37 Oshawa GM Strike. There's going to be a public talk by Tony at a different book list. And I may as well start with that since that's what I started with. And that is going to be Wednesday, October 30, at 7 p.m. at 779 Bathurst Street, Toronto. And you can also order this book. You can order it now from barakabooks.com. I want to say, by the way, we've been talking about, of course, we've interviewed Tony regularly on the show. We want to stay with this topic. We're very interested in the developments with the United Auto Workers in the United States, who've come to the fore as a quite innovative, courageous, class-driven political, I called it political. The United Auto Workers has politics, and that is to say they take a stand for... on class issues, class solidarity. These are words which were alien to our language only in recent years, I should say, pretty much remains so. That people, for example, the worst expression of it, in my view, I mean, there are many, but people like to say, and the NDP is the most guilty of this, although they seem to be trying to correct themselves. This is the problem of people who always, you know, putting their finger in the wind to decide what they should say. So for years, they decided that the expression should be the middle class. And I've seen some pretty advanced thinkers, including Jeff Sachs, use the expression middle class. We have to have the middle class. I mean, the middle class is what... There's a problem in that expression. Because if you say the middle class, you're implying that there's a third class that you're not talking about. Because we all understand if you say middle class, okay, so there's the middle class versus what? The upper class? And who is this third entity that you're not mentioning? Well, the United Auto Workers delved into the question, and they found out it means the working class. And if you take what people call the middle class and look at it closely, it turns out to be the working class, actually. It's just that thanks to Tony Blair and Bill Clinton and the liberals of the Western imperialist capitalist order became obsessed with the idea that they wanted to, they didn't want to dirty their hands, frankly, or be seen associating with people who are called working class. And on this show, of course, we've been out of step all along, because workers are workers, and people who have to work for wages, and particularly those who build things, without whom nothing happens. So, at any rate, to go back, the United Auto Workers has been setting a course, and The book by Tony Leo, The Truth About the 37 Oshawa GM Strike, underlines the history of this, the roots to which UAW is now returning and honoring, because, you know, it's the old problem. If you don't know where you came from, you don't know where you're going. And it, the book centers on the development of the Congress of Industrial Organization, CIO, is certainly a major player in the book, and a focus. And when the CIO was reaching out to industrial workers and with the strategy of not making the center of organization skills, the old AFL, American Federation of Labor concept, which it was workable. It was not that it was a bad idea, but when it became, when it excluded the so-called unskilled, particularly as industrialization major monopolies in auto and steel began to build enormous factories and refineries and whatnot, that model didn't work any longer if you were trying to organize. And so the CIO developed a strategy. And it became, in the eyes of major motor companies, auto companies, Henry Ford and GM and those, they saw that they weren't just, when they made their attacks, they weren't focused just on UAW, the attempt to form the United Auto Workers. But the great villain of the day was John L. Lewis. If you wanted to see a, put the fear of God, as they call it, into a major owner, a major monopolist, you just mentioned John L. And matter of fact, there was hardly a thing would happen. There was a period, a decade or so, where if you wanted to know what American labor thought, the individual that seemed to most represent the thinking was John L. Lewis. And that was, and Tony Leo's book, The Truth About the 37 Oshawa GM Strike, brings this out, because Mitch Hepburn, the Premier of Ontario, when he talked about the attempt to organize, the successful organization drive of 37, as in his books, he was fighting John L. Lewis. And I suppose it was part of the strategy was to say, well, you see, he's not a Canadian, he's in the States, and he's, and there's this terrible monopoly of workers. If, when people talk about anti-monopoly, the capitalists always talk about unions as though they represent a monopoly. So the great monopolist of labor was John L. Lewis, in their view. But it was a very healthy phenomenon, and it transformed organized labor. And the book goes into this in detail. The book also centers on our failure, focuses somewhat on our failure to get the story right. That over the years, there's, because of McCarthyism, there's been a tendency to tell the story as being a problem of foreign incursion into the Canadian labor movement, with the suggestion by Irving Abella in his book that the Canadians would have been able to organize GM Oshawa and the auto plants without CIO UAW connections. And in trying to make that case, they not only argued that that was possible, but that workers at GM Oshawa were not assisted not materially assisted by the both CIO through either funds or organizers. And by the way, never underestimate the need for a trained, a really committed, I would say ideologically committed labor organizers. People who work for salaries tend not to be so driven. They have other issues, like their own salaries. But the great organizers have never been motivated primarily by what can they get out of it. And there was a very dedicated group of people, many of them communists, as a matter of fact. So Abella suggested there hadn't been any material support, and that this could have all come about without international solidarity and mutual respect amongst workers in the auto business. He, frankly, either neglected information or hid it from his readers, and over the years, this fed into an ideology in hereabouts of a kind of nationalism, which was which falsified that story because it would benefit some contemporary political cause. And there was, of course, the overriding need, particularly amongst Social Democrats, the NDP, used to be the CCF, to belittle or mock or to actually try to undermine the work of those members of those organizers and working people at the plant in GM to try to drive a wedge between them and people who had a communist philosophy. But again, it's as old as dirt to say that actually these are inseparable phenomena. People who do believe in the need to eliminate the exploiting classes, and that's a common idea. That isn't one that was thought up by Karl Marx alone. It was thought up by many people. Is it? We need a society based on popular will, the will of majority, the needs of the majority, and the majority overwhelmingly are workers. And so it's inherent to being in that class that this idea will exist in your mind if you're one of the exploited, because who are they to take from you the extra value you produce and put it in their pocket, or spend it on armaments, or spend it on breaking up unions, or laying you off, cutting your wages, moving their factories. Who are they to do that if we're one society and we're interested in we have a common class interest? So it was that kind of outlook, of course. It was the fertile ground that created a very successful and very democratic move to build and establish a union at GM in 1937. And as I say, the story has been either neglected or falsified to serve political interests of various people. Therefore, bring it back to this. You need to get this book, The Truth About the 37 Oshawa GM Strike. The author is Tony Lea. The book launch will be at a different book list, a wonderful bookstore at 779 Bathurst Street. And that's going to be Wednesday, October the 30th at 7 p.m. I'll just read you a little promo on the book, which quotes it, runs this way. "Oshawa has fallen," wrote the monthly New Commonwealth. One week ago, it was known as the home of General Motors. Today, it belongs to the United Auto Workers International Union. That was a contemporary comment. How did the auto workers at the GM plant in Oshawa in 1937 beat a rabidly anti-union government, a hostile press, and the world's largest corporation? The conventional wisdom popularized by academic Irving Abella has obscured the truth about the 37 strike for 50 years. Abella claimed the international UAW was a hindrance, not a help. He downplayed the role of both Reds and rank-and-file workers. And Abella completely ignored the role of women strikers, stewards, and bargainers. I'll just continue. Tony Leo reveals what actually took place at the Oshawa GM plant in 1937 through the voices and actions of rank-and-file workers and shop floor activists that have been covered up, for decades. We need to study the lessons of the 37 strike. It can provide a guidepost for workers today who are striving to revive a fighting labor movement that can win. And here I would say editorially, this Taylor Report, UAW is exactly as it is today, led by a reform group which has really changed its leadership and knocked off a leadership which had really sunk to the depths of corruption, and several of them went to prison, actually. It got so bad even the capitalists couldn't stand them. And this book is promoted by Wayne praised by Wayne Luchuk, Professor Emeritus at McMaster University, who says, it's clear, he's speaking of the book, it's clear, it's thorough, it reads almost like a novel. And then Sid Ryan says of the book, it takes the tenacity and truthfulness of a grassroots activist to tell the real story of working class politics. Tony Leo does just that in this behind-the-scenes tale of the historic 37 strike. Tony Leo is a longtime union activist with experience in bargaining, a shop floor representation, labor education, and political mobilization. A maintenance and construction welder with GM Oshawa for nearly 40 years, he has held many positions at Local 222 and with the National Union. He holds an MA in Labor Studies from 2023 from McMaster University. Lives in Toronto. It must be a good guy. Here's the part I meant to mention earlier, too. The truth about the 37 Oshawa GM strike includes over 60 photos, many never before published. And I've got the book here. It is, I tell you, it's really a kick to look at the pictures because it was a massive operation, a bunch of really wonderful people. From the book, I remember that Mitch Hepburn, who tried to create a kind of vigilante operation he said, the Reds are going to take over Oshawa, so he had to get ready with his, and he formed a group called the communist press referred to as Hepburn's Hussars. And he was going to, and one of the tricks they use, this is quite common in trying to break unions, is to call on veterans. You say, oh, veterans, you know, this is terrible. People here who don't believe in the, you know, support the queen or king. I guess it was the king at the time. And the veterans should show up and discipline the strikers and make them go back to work and beat them up. That would be the goal. And incidentally, the book mentions in Windsor, I get that wrong, not Windsor. It'll come to me. But there were places that didn't succeed to try to organize, and they were a lot of them were mugged, where people came. They were trying to. There was a popular tactic of the day was a sit down. That is, you stay in the workplace, and you don't harm anybody, but you just make sure that the plant doesn't work, it doesn't operate, and then you stay there while the bargaining goes on. So the Hepburn Hussars types decided that they would go in to the plant and beat up on those who were sitting down, and they did it too. And some very serious injuries. People had their homes invaded, by the way, by these people, which Hepburn approved of. He thought that was appropriate. So those things actually happened. And then they had this idea that they were going to play up being a patriot and being a veteran. Well, they forgot, of course, or didn't notice that, you know, of course, workers are the ones who go into the army. So those organizing this UAW local with CIO help, they said, well, we have veterans. We've got plenty of veterans. And so they began to form into groups and march around and say, here's where the veterans are. And, of course, any veteran, real one, looking at them would know, yes, they are indeed. In fact, the majority of soldiers, practically everybody in the ranks, is from the working class. Now, you will find officers, but officers can't do a thing without soldiers. But when you start talking about, okay, this is post-World War I, and we want to remember how patriotic we were, well, it turned out that a good portion of those working in the GM plant were former soldiers, and they hadn't forgotten how to be soldiers, and they also knew how they had come by their medals or loss of friends, perhaps wounds themselves. So it was very interesting to see how this all of the Hepburn's weapons fell to the side because of solidarity. He met a wall of solidarity, and he tried every trick, debate foreigners and call on patriotism, etc. So the big thing is that the Oshawa strike was a success. It wasn't a long one, by the way, because even GM was recognizing it. You want to remember, this is an international phenomenon. And in that year of 37, this is when the sit-down strikes were at their zenith. And the thousands and thousands of workers were joining unions at that time. And the force was coming from CIO, UAW. And there were plenty of political people interested from all stripes. There were liberals who got involved supporting, particularly in the U.S., and some degree in Canada. There was certainly all varieties of socialists supported, because the right to organize is a fundamental right. But, of course, the ultimate weapon is red baiting. And that's a practice we have to call out, because we're in a period now where we're approaching is a kind of form. It's interesting that in speaking of China and Russia, who are now, we're told, it's like an Orwellian moment where they say our former friends are now the worst enemies we ever had and that kind of thing. So now there is this thing of, they call them a sovereign government in Eastern Europe and Asia, hostile actor. And it's all a choice of words, because there's been no act of hostility toward us. That would be Canada, if it would mind its own business. And to call them hostile actors, it's just kind of bankrupt and stupid and gutless. But it still kind of works. And our parliament is so confused. Sometimes they think that Putin is a communist. They forget that Putin and his element took over only years and years after the fall of the Soviet Union. And the communists are not in power in Russia. But they go with this to such an extent that sometimes they forget themselves. There have been American politicians who refer to contemporary Russia as the Soviet Union, and they don't even check themselves. They just say it because it's habit. And therefore, they think it's they can just repeat these words. So I think we've covered that. I want to make sure the second event, and this is related, I suppose, in a, as I've been, as the way I've been telling it, how could it not be? Tamara Lorenz, who is an anti-NATO activist, we had her as a guest on this show, proud to say, has been, she's doing what used to be called people's diplomacy, where she visits, she goes all over the world, actually, arguing that NATO is a, never was a good idea, and its time is to, is over, and it should be dismantled, because NATO has become a major source of trouble in the world, and it has lied about who, its own identity, because now it talks about being in Asia, and it intervened in it in Libya. It's NATO bombed Serbia, and as she pointed out on our show, they when they did that, by the way, they struck a Chinese. I think it was the personnel who were killed, or Chinese personnel were at a radio facility. I believe that's what they were doing. It wasn't I don't think it was directly their embassy, but it doesn't really matter. These were Chinese civilians who were killed. The Americans and NATO, which is America, United States is the iron fist in the glove of NATO, and they knew what they were targeting, and they were sending, it used to be called a shot across the bow in naval terms, just a little signal to China that they might be next, that they were going to beat up on Yugoslavia, the remains of it, which they had ripped to pieces. Yugoslavia was one of the things that maintained peace. It was a political structure of nations, and it was a workable one, and it contributed to stability, and so NATO hates stability. NATO makes war on stability. So Tamara Lorenz went most recently and most notably to Russia, and as did others. She was attending conferences where people came from all over the world. Russia is not isolated, and it's one of the tragedies and farces of Canadian foreign policy to pretend that Russia is isolated. Actually, many, many nations, particularly now in Africa, are quite pleased that Russia is asserting itself as a sovereign country and is not following orders from NATO. It tried, by the way, more than it should have, in my opinion, to see if they could accommodate NATO, but there's no accommodating NATO. Can't be done. NATO is a master, and so they don't have conversations with others. Either you are, as Bush himself said, with us or you're against this. And so, and if you want to be with us, you have to put your hands up and do as you're told. And sovereign countries, large ones, capable of handling themselves, both China and Russia can definitely handle themselves, refuse to be dealt with in those terms. At any rate, many people around the world are, of course, happy with this development, and they're anxious to be part of a world where states are equal, treated equally. And I would say they want to rebuild the United Nations. You notice we're in a phase now where the United Nations is being called into question. To give you the most gross example, the Secretary General of the United Nations was going to visit Israel, and they told him he was not welcome. That should have been a headline here, but it wasn't. And now we have UN personnel, the so-called UNIFIL, in Lebanon. They're attacked by a UN member state, and the UN member state, that is Israel, is ordering them to get out of the way because they want to do things in Lebanon. Well, they're going to the wrong address. If you want to do that, you have to take it to the United Nations General Assembly or Security Council. Otherwise, this would be a state making war on the UN. That's a fact. That's a simple, observable fact. And Canada is slowly drifting, following U.S. lead in attempting to bypass the United Nations. They still want to use the words international community. They like the words rules-based order. And they're being told by African states, they're being told by states of South America, they're being told by China and by Russia, and some European states are being told by Hungary, they're being told by Slovakia. There is a place to talk, and that's called the UN. It is not a little gang that meets in with Washington and calls itself a New World Order, or those who have a rules-based order, which is bunk. There are international laws, and they are not created by the United States and Canada. There are treaties. And these are treaties amongst equals, where sides agree. And there are treaties to make this more, give it some gravitas. This is done through the United Nations, which was created on the corpse of Nazism. And it was agreed that all people are equal, because after all, you remember, Nazism was a challenge to the concept of human equality. They said they weren't. They said that they were the Übermensch, they had a right to rule because they were superior people, and they tried and they murdered tens of millions in Europe. By the way, when we talk about, again, I said this on the show before, but you talk about slaughter and genocide, and they say, oh, in the global south, there's so much violence. There's never been violence like that carried out in Europe by Europeans on Europeans. The global South could look on in horror at the magnitude of the violence and the weaponry that was employed to destroy tens of millions of people. That was good old Europe that did that. So the idea of racial superiority and an order led by the famous Five Eyes, who are white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, they dominate. They say they do. And they have their own club, and you can't join, by the way. France tried to join Five Eyes, and they were told no. And why? Well, because Five Eyes doesn't speak French. And so they're hiding a little secret. They have a little problem with their thinking themselves superior and the right to intervene and dictate and to use any means to dominate other people. Back to Tamara Lorenz. She speaks on Tuesday, October the 22nd, 7 p.m. at Solidarity Place. That's a Hamilton and District Labor Council. That is 51 Adair Avenue. That's Tuesday, October 22nd, 7 p.m., 51 Adair Avenue. And Tamara is going to report on what it was like to meet with people, mainly women's organizations, by the way, because she belongs to several organizations that are led by women. It used to be, I don't know the exact title, but Women for Peace. And they have had these conferences for years, but because let's use this term, an iron curtain has been drawn across Europe, not by Russia, but by the West. Because of that, you have to be a courageous person to go and speak with people from around the world about the need for respect for international institutions and international law, and to break up the exclusive military alliance that has been the curse of recent history, that is NATO. And Tamara has done that. And she is following in the footsteps of people who, in another time, tried to break this isolation trick played by the West. It was the West, by the way, that drew the so-called Iron Curtain. It was Winston Churchill was the main figure in it. Harry Truman was a major figure in it. And they are the ones who decided that we couldn't interact with the people of Russia because they weren't obeying our orders. Therefore, we couldn't have anything to do with them. We had to see if we could ruin them and see if we could destroy them. And behind that lies many more stories. I think we'll take a break. I want to come back on this theme of the damage done by the so-called Iron Curtain and the efforts, the courageous efforts of people like Tamara Lorenz pull that curtain down. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and I guess we're going to have maybe our banjo guys. Oh, wait a minute. No. Yes. I'm getting a yes. Pedro's right. I think we'll go with that. And we'll be back.
Some blues are just blues. Mine are the minor blues. Some blues are just blues, mine are the minor blues. My troubles are coming by threes and by twos. Blues and more blues, it's the cold black blues. Blues and more blues, it's the cold black blues. Got coal in my hand, got coal in my shoes. They are the cool black blues. These blues are so blue. They are the cool black blues. For my faithful caveman and my life I will lose. You say they are blue. These are the minor blues. You say they are blues. These are the minor blues. I must have sharpened these picks that I use.
There we go. That was Old Flat and Old Scruggs. I always mention that the Scruggs family jumped in and opposed the Vietnam War, which damn near blew the lid off Nashville. That was unthinkable because, well, I don't want to say why, because the answer is embarrassing. But the fact is that the U.S. has always tried to play a kind of southern card. And they always make it to flatter the South that they're the real soldiers, and they always commit, and they never doubt, and they're going to carry out all the... They love war songs, and you have to think of a guy like Merle Haggard, who I admire very much, but he's a damn fool when it came to Vietnam, and he eventually admitted it, which is... But he wasn't loud enough. But at any rate, there was always an attempt to play up the idea that there's a portion of the country that just you could count on 100%. They never asked any questions. They just went to war. And then good old Earl Scruggs, he spoke up. And that was, he knocked a big hole in that concept. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT. It's 89.5 FM. And I want to mention this thing of breaking the wall, the curtain, I should call it, curtains for the curtain. We have a precedent for this, of course, and that was people like Paul Robeson and others in the United States who also had argued that, look, let's honor the founding documents of the United Nations, which is the concept of mutual respect and commitment to diplomacy among states, and the rejection of superiority to any race, nation, or religion. And when Black Americans were fighting for their rights. NATO was founded, by the way, at a time when the United States was an apartheid country. They don't use the term. There's a sort of a sneaky quality about this. They say we were segregated. Well, yeah, you were segregated. That was apartheid. Black people could not go into hotels. They could not get employment. They were lynched, and no one was ever prosecuted for these things because that was considered Southern culture. By the way, many of those lynched were U.S. servicemen, Black servicemen who wore their uniform. You see, having the uniform of the United States military gave them, of course, recognition and status, which the South, by segregation laws, denied. So the sight of a Black man who would presume to be a corporal, a sergeant, someone who had served, see that person in the eyes of the Klan, who were a highly powerful force, caused violence. The identity was the source of the violence. And who was fighting it? Well, Paul Robeson fought it, and Albert Einstein, and incidentally, Baraka Books is bringing out Einstein on Israel and Zionism. I'm going to tell the story again because people don't seem to know it, particularly the people who are experts on Einstein. I've said on the show, and I'll keep saying, that there are library shelves covered with books and biographies and studies and praise of the great Albert Einstein, which do not mention the fact that Paul Robeson and Albert Einstein and W.E.B. Du Bois formed an organization to make lynching a federal offense. And the Roosevelt and Truman administrations and others following them did not act on that. And not only did they not act on it, people who claim some knowledge can tell you the intimate details of Einstein's life, do not mention that, which means conscious repression, hiding a fact, which would help people to, as it was designed to do, to understand their own history and to do the right thing in against segregation. So, thanks to Fred Jerome, who is a guest on this show on several occasions, and a very brave journalist. His own father went to prison, by the way, under the Smith Act in the United States, which was to repress people who spoke against, of all things, NATO, and spoke against segregation. And so that Fred Jerome's father, he's always known by his initials. I can't even tell you what the initials are for. V.J. Jerome, if you want to look him up. He's in the history books. He, of course, was quite being proud of the fact that his own family had interacted with Robeson and with that campaign to make lynching a federal offense, which I think it may have finally passed. It might have been in the 1980s, and I'm not absolutely certain. They're not patting themselves on the back about it because they're afraid they might lose the votes of a great number of racists. But it took a great struggle to do that. Albert Einstein was one of those who believed in diplomacy. And this book, this new book, Einstein on Israel and Zionism, basically it covers, it's Albert Einstein writing on the subject, and it's wonderful because it's letters, it's his letters to newspapers going back to when he was living in Switzerland and Germany, Europe, and he's writing to the European press as Nazism was developing in the 1930s. And it's to have a brilliant individual and a socialist, Einstein was a declared socialist, to have him to, in real time, talking about what was developing and how it was being combated and how to combat it, and to see him address the issue of what to do following World War I and up to World War II, and then following that, what sort of relations could be constructed between the former colonized world, nations that were coming into being, and the Western capitalist powers who thought that all decisions were their decisions, up to them to make. Einstein argued, no, that you could only have a healthy people and future if you recognize the equality and rights of each individual, but also of sovereign countries. So he was very sensitive to this issue of the development of the State of Israel, and he argued and participated in at a high level in most of the discussions. And his, by the way, his opinion was not an authoritarian type position. He listened. He knew most of the participants. He knew, and he went out of his way to get to know, for example, Egyptian leaders for whom he had respect, particularly the editor of the most influential newspaper in Egypt. Einstein sought him out, requested conversations with him, because he thought it was his duty to actually conscientiously without any hidden agenda or notion of superiority of one party over the other, that it could, that peace could be achieved. His greatest problem, he pointed out, was that the imperial system had not died, and the imperial system was going to, particularly the UK, followed later by the US, would try to exercise a fiat, a domination. And he was against that. Just as people today, now, you can see by the votes at the General Assembly, are overwhelmingly of the same opinion as Albert Einstein. So people should actually obtain this book, Einstein on Israel and Zionism, Baraka Books, Fred Jerome. It has a second essay in it, one that most listeners, even to the Taylor Report, which is a very smart bunch of people, have not read Albert Einstein's, Fred Jerome's essay on the death of Count Bernadotte. And by the way, it couldn't be more timely than to read it now. Count Bernadotte was a UN representative who was assigned by the Security Council at the time of the formation of the State of Israel and the anticipated formation of a Palestinian state. If you want to know why we have this term, two-state, it is a United Nations project. It is a United Nations sanctioned, blessed concept in order for the two peoples to live at peace and as equals. And Bernadotte was in, and I think I have the year right, 48, maybe it was 47, was sent to take part in negotiations to achieve the ends that I've outlined. And when he did, while he was doing that, there were armed groups, secret armed groups, I think the name for one was the Irgun, were opposed to his being present. They didn't like or want this project to go forward. And he was assassinated, Count Bernadotte. And so Fred Jerome raised the question, which at the time everyone thought was highly pertinent and agreed to, who killed Count Bernadotte? Well, all the individuals involved are now known. Their names are known. They were never prosecuted. A high-ranking UN official trying to bring peace between Palestinians and those who became Israelis was machine-gunned. And by the way, I think there were two men with him, both of whom were also killed. And the essay ends with identification and discussion of how they lived out their lives quite happily and openly talked about their role in the murder of Bernadotte. It's very pertinent to today because now we have UN personnel being attacked, and I don't know that the being threatened, menaced, and I don't know that the Canadian government has said anything. The EU has, not that it counts for 2 cents, but just for the record, they didn't do it. So far, there hasn't been any real condemnation of this dangerous sign of how far the Israelis are prepared to go, and it should be something that everybody is concerned about. And I would remind you that now, some years ago, we interviewed on this show the widow of a Canadian Army officer who was serving with the UN peacekeepers, who was at his post doing his duty, not armed. He was monitoring as he was assigned to do. He was on Lebanese soil. He was killed by a direct hit by the Israeli forces. And Canada very quietly let the whole matter drop. And I'm embarrassed to say that we haven't returned to that. It's a kind of issue that Taylor Report, and if we had journalists, others might cover as well. But we don't. They simply look the other way or decide not to mention. That's a Canadian army officer shot, killed by a direct strike. And by the way, he told them, you're firing close to my position. I know you're not trying to harm me, but you're firing close to my position. They said, what is your position? He told them exactly what it was, and then they hit it. And Canada looks at its feet. Well, let me put the central point there. It's not the Israelis. It's the U.S., which has sanctioned and said that they want Israel to be the prevailing power. That's why it has a nuclear bomb. That's why it has the very best and finest and latest weapons. And in the past few days, a new thing has happened. U.S. military personnel are being openly talked about as being assigned to operate some of the most sophisticated weaponry the U.S. has, and they're going to take it to Israel, and they're going to use it. But the Israelis, like the Ukrainians, who have asked for the same weaponry, do not themselves have the capability of operating it, because it's a kind of a small club that gets to have that, to use it, to make a pun, metaphor. To use that club, you've got to be a member of the club. And they're going to be there. So just as in Ukraine, we now have the United States putting itself more and more in the forefront, because it's their project. The colonialists decided they had to have a loyal friend in Ukraine to make trouble for the Russians, and they had to have a super loyal friend in the Middle East to make trouble for the Arabs. So when Einstein, for example, said, let us have diplomacy, they laughed. And today, 2024, the U.S. is getting ready to cover its bet. And so all fighters in the region know, whether it's Iran, Syria, the fighters of South Lebanon, that's a political party, one of the largest in Lebanon, Hezbollah, they know that they're not fighting Israel, they're fighting the U.S. And the U.S. is quietly telling them, if something happens, we will up the ante. So I hope everybody's ready for the show, because it is no longer predictable as to what the outcome will be. So that's where we've gotten to today. There's more things to do. And by the way, I'm going to tell you, next week we will be talking to a gentleman who's written a wonderful book discussing, among other things, the grandfather of Christopher Freeland. You know, there's a subject, who were the 900 Nazis brought into the country improperly? Question number one, was Christian's granddad one of them? That's one of the questions I will ask. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT. There's a wonderful show coming up. See you next week.